Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Who's this?
I'm David in St. Augustine, Florida. I'm just waiting for the meeting to start as well.
Oh, me too. I'm Kathy in South Broward,
Hi.
Florida.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. It was just very quiet on the line.
I know.
Maybe everyone's getting ready for Thanksgiving.
I checked to make sure I had the right number in, and I did, so.
Yes, me too.
Hello, this is Danny Bedoni. How's everybody?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good, good, good. So we have, is David there already?
No.
David.
I think I've heard
No,
his voice.
David Rucker is here. This David is here.
Fearless leader has not appeared yet.
Well, it's just on the hours. I'm sure he'll be in soon.
Yes.
Oh, a minute has. We hope so. I didn't receive any emails saying the contrary.
Yeah, me neither. But it's odd that he.
Well, hi everybody and welcome. I had trouble getting on my own bridge line. I hope you guys are all doing great. Let's spend some minutes checking in, questions, clarifications, things that you've thought about or have mulled over that you'd like to talk just a bit more about before we move into our seminar for today. Any thoughts, questions, or reflections? Is this,
Well,
go ahead. This is who? Didn't mean to scare you off. Go ahead with a question or comment. Anyone, thoughts, questions, things that might be helpful to talk just a bit more about? If not, we'll move into our subject, but I appreciate the questions and comments that some of you have sent in, the kind words. Let me just mention one thing that I haven't sort of looped into the discussion, and this is a question by David about shame and guilt, and how we can incorporate that in coaching. It's important, I think, to distinguish between the two. Shame is the failure to live up to an internal ideal. In other words, the ideal that you have of who and what you want to be, living up to that generates esteem. It's the only place I know self-esteem comes from. Not living up to it generates shame. I know we touched on this, but I wanted to clarify and expand just a little bit. Guilt is a sense of doing what's wrong, and basically looking at this question of how do you help someone in this regard. One of the things that I find really helpful is to ask often at the beginning or to send them an exercise to distinguish a new client, to distinguish between, to clarify needs and ideals. Because so much of what we do is based on being clear about what specifically our needs and our own ideals are. And that way, whenever you work with a client to establish goals and strategy, when they're in the same direction as their needs and ideals, all of them is going in the same direction. So that's a really powerful experience. And sometimes someone has goals or even creates strategies that are not aligned with their needs and ideals. So we can talk a bit more about that if that makes sense enough for right now. Remember I mentioned that we'd do a an open discussion at the end of our final seminar next week at the top of the hour for anyone who's interested to hang around and just have a discussion. If there are things that may not make sense or you'd like to talk more about or want to do a 1 minute case vignette or anything that would be helpful to you in applying this and making it very accessible and integrated into your way of thinking as a mentor coach. So one other call, any other thoughts, questions, comments from anyone?
Just wanted to thank you, David, for that. This is David, and that distinction is excellent, and I really appreciate it. And, of course, other things are feeding into this as well and helping. Thank you.
Okay, super, super. And we'll get to the other aspect of your question and application perhaps in the discussion next time. So additional comments, thoughts, anybody? If not, we'll move right into what we're supposed to be talking about. Okay, I'm going to put us on mute so you don't have to worry about the background noise. Okay, we're going to talk about how to mindset map for growth in this seminar. Remember from last seminar, a state of mind is like a software program that determines how we perceive, process, and how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. And that's how we stay on track or how we get stuck. And the selection of the very best and most current software program for what we want to do is immensely helpful. So mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, what we do. Mindsets contain the powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves. Here's an example. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while we navigate our daily lives moment by moment. The human brain operates analogous to a Google map. Rather than one big map, the brain makes a whole series of maps to operate. That's why we need a cohesive story to tie all of this together and be sure we're all of us, each of us, going in the same direction. This is where we find immense usefulness as a coach for our story and to help a client develop their stories. So, for example, when a new situation arises, a map is booted up to determine what to do. This explains why we have different contexts or frames for different situations. We have different states of mind or mindsets. So we want to be sure the mindset is current, that it's the best suited for what we're doing. So these mindset maps are stored in the hippocampus, in the midbrain, and that's the brain's memory focal point. So this entire software package is complete and internally consistent. And remember, there are several software packages. So remember we talked about state comes first, then strategy and story. The mindset comes first. And this, I illustrated this earlier to say our brains can't tell the difference between excitement and anxiety. There's activation, and how we interpret it determines whether we're going to frame it as anxiety and danger and we better be careful, or as excitement and engagement and proceeding with it. So how we frame something determines how we're going to engage it and what mindset we boot up to deal with it. So meaning determines your behavior. So to change your behavior, you have to change the meaning you attach. Remember, we talked in last seminar, the three steps to rewire your brain. So let's look in more detail at mind maps, the brain story. The brain connection or mind maps influences the reality that we see. The mind map is the brain story. Now, a paradigm, and that's roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. So the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. So each of us has a number of maps or storylines, paradigms in our head. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we see things the way they are. These paradigms that influence the way we see things then determine how we structure meaning and how we think and behave. So we originally construct our beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. This is even without words and a language, but just the experience that accrues and the experiences that we create. The beliefs then become predictors and confirm the reality that generates them. Let me give you an example, an application of this. This is a study out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to live in separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They each had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. They entered their ape colonies, didn't communicate with each other, lived for a year, and then emerged to compare notes. And they and their research teams expected remarkable similarities, but there were significant discrepancies, huge differences. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a harmony and a unity with the apes, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery. He remained careful and vigilant, always was watchful, right on the cusp of a conflict, it seemed, never created that harmony and that connected comfort with the ape colony. Now, the anthropologist did not understand or have any explanation for the discrepant results. They and their teams puzzled months to find a difference. They couldn't find anything. Finally, after several months, they discovered one difference. The anthropologist, who was the careful outsider and never got comfortable, had a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist, who had no gun, had a commitment, a belief that he was going to, from the beginning, make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. So to get someone's belief, you may simply ask, well, how do you know? And as coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs that ghostwrite behaviors. We listen for the subtext of the story that the client creates. Remember, 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious. So we're seeing what comes alive in the process about limiting beliefs, about unconscious biases, about blind spots, about assumptions that don't work. So we're listening for the story and to see what works and what doesn't. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So with this understanding of the map, the mindset, rather than each situation being overwhelming or chaotic or a new experience, our attention just automatically shifts into organizing frames of reference, the mind map. So we listen for that and collaborate to get the client to reflect on this too and pick, and I'll give you some examples or vignettes from cases in just a bit, to find the most effective mind map. We often relate it to something we know, and that suggests an immediate action. Or we ask a client, have you ever had an experience like this in the past that you dealt with successfully? So one of our unique qualities as a human being is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. So that means we can learn from our own experiences and from those of others. The danger, of course, is that we place a new experience into the container of what we know or what's automatic, which can prevent new learning. So this is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created an old story. We are not our habits or thoughts. We can think about things, reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. An example here is if a client characterizes some things that they have done that may have become a habit, and a habit is simply a collection of repetitions, if they characterize that or regard it as if it were an identity, it will be harder to change. So this, of course, immediately as a coachable moment, a client may say, well, you know, I said I was going to do it, but I'm a procrastinator. Well, what we may want to focus on at that instant is, did you have a plan? And that's, of course, the first thing. And if you had a plan, when you got to the point and the commitment to take the first step, how did you stop yourself? Because being a procrastinator is no explanation. That simply characterizes a bunch of choices, a collection of habitual responses. So this is where we look each moment at the choice architecture of how someone chooses. And this is why we focus in coaching on the present moment, the choice architecture of the present moment, of how a client decides and looking at becoming more aware of better ways of choosing. Because even though someone has made responses habitual and it's operating on the default mode, it still can be a choice if you take it off of autopilot and look at it here and now. So a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So here's where coaching can be effective as well. At a macroscopic level, the bigger picture, selecting the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or even developing a meta map. An example, someone feels anxious and uncomfortable about trying something new, about changing. We help them read this uncertainty or anxiety as a way of possibly reframing it to look at the challenge, at the opportunity, and even the uncertainty and trepidation, even anxiety, if that's what they experience, as validation that they're moving ahead past what they've done before. It's a signpost to being in a new place. So this is a very simple example of reframing. There's anxiety rather than danger, better head, recover. This is a validation of taking a step in a new direction. It's a signpost of progress. So this is something ultimately the client will need to do himself or herself to look at a proper framing for their experience so that they don't have a connection that stops them, and that they stop rather, or and that they frame it in a way to move ahead. Now, at a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. Now, here's an even simpler example. If you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. an example here. The example I've already given is labeling it as anxiety rather than excitement. But here's another example. If you feel bad about saying no to someone and label the feeling as guilt, you're going to boot up a really different map than if you see saying no as an appropriate boundary. No simply means no. No means that you have a self-care and a personal plan, and this is not something that you're going to choose to deviate at this point. You're going to stick to your plan. You're taking care of yourself. So no simply means no. Thanks, I have other plans and other things to do. So think about if no boots up a mindset of guilt, or no simply is part of a plan of self-care and sustaining that, very different outcomes. Now here's an example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, who was asked by her dad, I want you to be the executor of my estate. And my client, his daughter, said, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some of the basic things about your property and wishes. He said, well, that's none of your business. So mindsets can be conflicting. Now, remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. They're the reality of your client. They're your reality, your belief. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each create. So, we need to recognize that we each create our own stories. And here's the sidebar to each of them. Begin with your story. Get your story really clear, really well understood, and you're going to be in the best position to help your clients with it. You probably already are. You've probably been working at it, and that's great. But to take ownership of your story in order to see what needs to change, needs to be enhanced, or simply ignored. So, when you map a new story, part of that navigation is the brain's error detection mechanism. Our brain creates patterns of connections in an ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. In fact, I'll make a note. It occurs to me. I'm going to send you a white paper that I did on attachment patterns. It's an attempt to look at attachment patterns in the light of how it might be useful in coaching. So I'll send you an email with that white paper as an attachment, so you can get an idea of, you know, when I say that all the algorithms that are there that are important, you're going to see in coaching, whether they're about thoughts or feelings or action, any kind of behavior, they're there. This is an example of one. So, we create patterns of connections as we move forward. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. So, discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains have an actual error detection mechanism. A portion of our brain, this is an anatomical reality in the brain. It's not a collective function like mirror neurons, but it's a place in the brain located very close to the emotional center. As soon as there's something not expected, a pattern that's not already ingrained, the error detection mechanism says, wait, that's not what I expected. There's a kind of discomfort that is created. The error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things that we do wrong, and we may struggle to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, or any experience that's in a new territory, and even a first step, will set off that error detection response. Meaning, if we give advice or you know, give somebody a, you know, slip in a camouflaged suggestion in the form of a question, it's going to set off an error detection mechanism, and most likely meaning that someone can reject the idea before they even consider it. So it places another barrier to change. So, which is why telling a client what to do may directly trigger the error detection mechanism. And it's why we focus on problems, because that energizes and it, because it activates the error detection mechanism. The mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain period or context in our lives, such as stress or in childhood, just may simply not be applicable in a situation now. If the software has been outdated, the hard wiring is not permanent and it can be revised. That's where we're in business as coaches. When change occurs in a systematic and consistent way, such as with collaborative contingent conversations, our specialty, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. The brain's error detection mechanism can even be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So, and this is in the outline. This is where I'm sticking to the outline. There are 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. Each of these, I believe, will help you be informed in your conversations with clients. First, as we just talked, change generates discomfort. Remember that. Remember to empathically resonate with a client when they are uncomfortable about moving ahead, so that they don't interpret it as their intuition tells them they're not doing the right thing, or my gut says this is a wrong decision. No, I say no too quickly, but listen for, though each of those two may be correct, but recognize together with your client that everything new and different is going to be attendant with some discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated have become habits, hardwired in the brain, default mode. Neuronal pathways and neural acts, neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how to drive the same way to work every day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things. Listen to a book, as I mentioned before. This default mode is energy efficient because it frees up the brain to do other things. Now, when these habits are confronted and change, the autopilot in the midbrain gets disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process the thinking. So basically, it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and preserve the default habit. Never mind that it's limiting, that it has a glass ceiling, that it's frustrating. At least we know the outcome. The brain naturally resists change. And to hardwire behavior to save energy so that it's going to oppose what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense to hardwire things. This is what we have to appreciate with a client when there's pushback, or to help the client deal with pushback, the resistance to change, from a family, from an organization, from a partner. That's their natural response. Their brain is responding to the perception of change and wanting things to get back like they should. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know it yet. So our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs can turn genes off and turn them on. I heard him say this directly in a presentation. Ray Kurzweil also wrote this in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Here's how he put it, so simply. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Two, the second area that, the second principle of how the brain operates to facilitate change. Change creates dissonance. We see what we, and this is very related, we see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect, the error, that's when the error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. So here's some practical applications. Since this portion of your brain has the job description to recognize and connect, or correct errors, consider the emotional expense of two things. A lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. Triple work. Another, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense, the dissonance in your brain, your error detection mechanism that reads that you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay the interest on the debt. Triple work again. You can deceive others, even your own mind. But your brain always knows. Now, the good news, the neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we also respond to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and printout to change itself, like misinterpreting a step into the new and different as if it were your gut or your intuition telling you this is a bad thing. Now, I want to return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. If you have a pen, I'd like to do a very brief exercise with you. I'm going to tell you three numbers. I'm going to tell you some numbers. Okay? One, two, four, five, seven, and eight. What's missing? Maybe an answer is three and six, or multiples of three. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of six numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything occurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. J. Paul Getty said there are three key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes, listing two things and then a third non sequitur, set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it, or can make it, a challenge to override both emotion and brain pattern to make wise and balanced decisions. This is especially where, if you want to change, create a system and stick with a plan. Four, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Consider this. You're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer, neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short-term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. In other words, back to what we talked before about neuroscience and quantum physics emphasize that we get what we focus on. So focusing on being on time, either positively or negatively, is not going to have the play that you want it to. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. Remember, we discussed this before. I gave you an example that the professional athletes and actors I work with in mentor coaching, they're not motivated to go to the gym in off-season or regularly, but they do because they know that that's what they have to do what's next. All you need to do something, whatever you decide to do, eat more vegetables, lose weight, whatever you decide to do, all you need is a plan and to stick to it, a system. Motivation isn't essential. Only a plan and sticking to it are. For example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You just have a plan and stick to it. You can make one decision. You set up an automatic payment or participation plan that withdraws X amount of money every month out of your checking account. One good decision changes your life. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Whenever emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline especially, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. And there's a range of emotions. Anything that can read as stress. This is why self-talk is limited, or even self-talk can further this process if it's negative. When there's a possibility of reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of a reward. So that means that you have to be aware of more than the immediate response. A risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine, or a blackjack table, it's going to release dopamine. So here's what we know now. It's not the reward that causes this spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation of reward. When gamblers were studied, their excitement occurred, and they were hooked up to an fMRI, as they approached the slot machine. That increased brain firing and dopamine spike before they ever had a win. So the anticipation of reward can be even more satisfying than actually getting it. Because attaining the goal shuts down the chemical engine of anticipation and the pleasure chemical that goes with it. So looking forward to a big win or a big purchase can be more thrilling than actually getting it. This can contribute to buyer's remorse, the almost ubiquitous experience of a really anticipated new purchase not being quite as exciting as you thought it might be. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us create that engagement and anticipation, provide a little bit of stress long term. It's really more excitement and engagement than stress, but this enhances learning. The time window on this is up to a couple of hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 or more hours, with continued stressful experience, they go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So with sustained stress, people can make bad, emotionally charged decisions. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business, how much their brain has become habituated without a lot of change to what they do. They stay in one place, one position, get most entrenched. An example of a place that I see this experience and a kind of resistance in mentor coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company, founded 36 years ago, to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. Now, the last two principles I think are huge for mentor coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, new brain cells being generated no matter how old you are. 1, enriched environment, and 2, exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that can create more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust. Those are all things we do in mentor coaching, by the way. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells, the site of memory and creativity. How much do you think exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100% increase. Here's another finding. Chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus decline with chronic stress. 10. Neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. It's like rezoning and developing new cortical real estate. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Now, examples of this are people who play classical guitar. The number of neurons, the size of the brain in the particular area of the brain that's in charge of that activity increases. Same with other braille. The number of neurons in charge of the fingers that touch the braille increases dramatically. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become automatic so we don't even have to think about them. The patterns become hardwired and automatic. So the last thing I want to discuss is how to map change. And this is huge for mentor coaches. There are 6 elements, 6 crucial elements to map change. And I want to talk just a bit about each to understand and incorporate them. 1 is, as we've talked, regulating states of mind. This is the most fundamental, I believe. States of mind, as we've talked, are like software packages. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive, how we process information, and then what we do. A key element is to choose the state of mind that works best, meaning that someone is grounded and centered as they decide. Then they can enter that state of mind that has the automatic connections for deliberate practice. So when someone's in an emotional state and get triggered to a different state of mind, they're overbalanced in a way, or they're in a state that is not ideal for a particular task at hand. And again, in extreme stress, the emotional brain can hijack the intellectual logical brain and even hold it hostage. So what do? Your brain is working against you. Well, in any state of upset or any altered state whatsoever, the first order of business is to regulate feelings and restore a cool state of balance of left and right brain. With any kind of imbalance, any kind of emotional trigger to change a state of mind, it boots up a mindset that may not be ideal for a situation. It may not contain the deliberate practice of what you do. And here's an example in working with some athletes. They're in a performance flow. They have engaged and sustained a performance mindset to do practice that becomes automatic so that they don't have to think about it. They have access. If they stop and think about it, even for a moment, it's called a choke. So they have to sustain that flow, that performance flow, by staying in the state of mind that contains all of the patterns of their response. If we have more time, if you're interested, I'll give you some other illustrations. The number two element to map change, the powers and the focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. So the power of focus is not only aligning the energy field of the brain, but all the things you don't have to pay attention to, just like a map. When you have a map, a system, you look at what's next, where you're going, and when you work with a map, all the places, all the things that you don't pay attention to can be monumental so that you stay focused on what you want to do. You become what you think about. You put energy into what you want. You focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This creates resistance. And when you focus on what you want, what you don't want kind of falls away, kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. Three, visualize changes. There's a chapter from a book I did that's in the back of your outline in the resources section about the use of visualization as a way of rewiring the brain and a way of using affirmations to revise mind software. It's a systematic way to use visualization. I'm going to let you look at it without going over examples here. But it's an important tool that we can use. You may or may not want to use that, but sometimes it can be helpful, especially if someone is having difficulty really thinking about or conceptualizing what they want, or having a difficulty with being afraid of success. If they can consistently visualize it, and when you revisit that visualization again and again, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, it basically hardwires the brain so that the experience is there. You simply can find a way in coaching then to help someone strategically back into that. Four, insight changes the brain. The moment of insight, an aha experience, lights up the brain in three different areas that we can see on fMRI scans. This aha moment, this moment of insight, activates these centers in the brain, and that creates a new neurochemical reaction that enhances a state of mind toward more creativity and integration. So this is what happens when a client has an aha moment. Think about when you've had aha moments. It lets you think of things in a new and expanded and maybe even different way. And that leads to wanting other aha moments. As important as this insight-induced change is, the sustained attention is what hardwires it into the brain circuit to plan along with it, in other words. Five, take action. This is the last step in a simple coaching model of looking at, based on what we've talked about, what do you commit to do before we meet again that will give you some traction? The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes and producing results. This may be why, and this is a sidebar personal experience, why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester in community college owns a whole bunch of real estate on the west side of town. 6, transform identity. A new experience or idea has to be focused on consistently and frequently. Then brain circuitry is stabilized. The mindset, then, of identity incorporates this new experience to integrate it as part of an evolving self, as a component of your identity, an internal model of who and what you are. Otherwise, it's not integrated, and you may be prone to dismiss it as a not me, attribute it to luck or circumstance, or just something you did that's different. This is why vision needs to include the experience, the feeling of achieving it, for example. When you inhabit the entire episode, you make it part of your self-experience. Let me say that in a different way. The most powerful force of the human psyche is we always return to our identity. It's who we are. It's the bedrock of our operating system that we identify with and is such a default mode. This is what we need to help a client transform. When we help them transform the surface story, all the strategies and the successes, what they do, how they change, needs to be incorporated by that client into a transformation of their identity, their core operating system, so that it becomes a default mode. If someone changes and doesn't change their identity, they're going to revert back to the same behavior that they did before. The transformation into a change of identity. This is something that we can do throughout the process of engaging with a client. We may simply point out or highlight their experience to highlight perhaps at another time how different this is in terms of how they responded. How do they experience doing this in such a different way? And to point out the successes and the ways that they're incorporating insights, operating perhaps maybe more and more in a model of a growth mindset, or applying what was discussed about growth and doing things differently to this situation. So we highlight this so that the client downloads the process of this self-reflection, this self-empathy, this awareness of how and why and what they're doing thing, maybe not the why, but how and what they're doing, and owning it and recognizing themselves that they're incorporating it into a fundamental sense of who they are. Now, here's a summary set of bullets, okay? You see in your outline. Here are the specific principles that I'm summarizing, maybe adding a little bit, some specific principles to help clients change mind and brain behavior, how someone thinks, feels, and acts. Begin where the client is. Remember, the client's the stick figure in the circle. Your challenge to get inside that circle so the client will listen to you. A collaborative framework and empathic resonance. Begin where the client is. Help the client learn more about what they already know to develop self-reflection, to develop an awareness of different experiences, because you'll need it. You'll need to do that. Client will need to do it if 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious. You're going to make a whole lot of stuff that they do automatically something that they become aware of. You know, when an unconscious bias is no longer unconscious, then, hey, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns to encourage the practice. You heard me say more than once, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Don't focus on mistakes. This is the negative focus. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful things. You get what you focus on, not what you want, so be sure it's positive and in the direction that you want. Correct mistaken couplings. This can understand and build on existing networks, like the example that I gave where no boots up a mindset of guilt. There are different couplings. No can simply mean no. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Jung said, some problems can't be solved, they just got to be outlived. He said it a little better than that, but that's the same principle. We don't have to understand everything. We don't have to engage everything. What we may want to focus most on is now and next. Encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections, stories, analogies, metaphors. Create maps. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. The brain is always looking to, at one level, that it wants to repeat all the experiences, the excitement, the dopamine comes, the really good high, or the good pleasure chemical, comes from something unexpected. So, what's next? Stephen King said, all a writer ever has to do is to keep the reader asking, what happens next? The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So, finally, we want to give attention to a new experience, a new way of doing things, consistently and repetitively, and to highlight and conceptualize that, perhaps with a client, that will enhance the possibility of repetition. At the same time, the client is incorporating that as a new operating model, ultimately of a new sense of identity that includes all the experiences, the process, and the results of a growth mindset and the performance enhancement. So we're back in conversation mode, if you'll manage the background noise. Any thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything that we just talked about?
David, this is Danny Bedoni. Thank you for
this
incredible thing.
Are you holding it down in New York and not getting snowed in?
Oh, I'm in Ireland, so it's midnight here. It's 1 a.m.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. So ask me about this brain and this mapping on music. Have you done any research on music and how this has had new novelty connections in the brain? On music learning and music teaching.
Not directly, but I know your interest, and I have a feeling that you're going to make some contributions in this regard. What we know, some of the things that we know, is how music can immediately regulate a state of mind. How it can boot up a particular state of mind, such as of relaxation, or, as you know, from theater and film, to boot up a particular mindset that will fit whatever is happening. So music has a powerful induction capacity to induce a mindset, to induce relaxation. I mean, think about all the apps that you can subscribe to that are mindfulness, meditation, relaxation apps. They're primarily music. So what are your thoughts now from what you know in your background professionally about the answer to your question?
Well, I've worked in third world countries, and as you know, what I've discovered is this incredible change in the brain of how it has changed from kids that have no brain evolution towards something that they can focus on, because they're focused on the negative things, that when you put music and you just focus on music, that the brain develops. But I wanted to know if you had done any study of that so we could collaborate together on this theme.
Well, what is common to the effects of music on the brain are some of the same things and the same results to selective attention, to mindfulness meditation, and to gratitudes. And each of those, from very different vectors and very different kinds of ways, all have a very positive influence, not only when done consistently to change the brain, but to enhance the capacity to self-regulate, and even has effects on the immune system. So the mechanisms, and music is one of them, share a common ground of creating change in the brain for very positive ways, because they all have one common thing in mind, from what I've seen, is that it changes the focused energy field of the brain. And when that is done consistently, it creates or enhances neuronal changes for the better. So I think you're onto something, and I think it's really, I'm aware of music therapy, for example, and some studies from there doing this very thing. And that's, you know, when it's focused in a positive way, looking at rewiring the brain. So great question and great possibility. So thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
Glad
thank
you, you are thinking in that way. That's super. I would love to hear more, but I want to be sure we're hearing from anybody who has questions.
Kip.
Hey, Kip. How you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. Relaxation is great. You may want to avoid Stravinsky's Rite of Spring on that one.
Okay.
Could you say a few more things about correct mistaken coupling?
Okay. This is something that we do in coaching, and it gets back to the fundamental principle of framing. You know, that if someone has an immediate association that isn't working, we can help them look at how they're framing something. A mistaken coupling is an example I gave of saying no and feeling guilty. It's not exactly mistaken, but it certainly doesn't work, and no doesn't have to automatically mean there are other possibilities. So there can be mistaken. You know, think about, Kip, what you're familiar with. Think about all the associations that we have to money that may not be mistaken, but they certainly boot up a particular mindset. You work with a couple where to one person, money means security, the other, it means freedom. So we got a saver and a spender. We're going to have to create a joined common ground to look at how to proceed in a way that can be adaptive for both. So the couplings are important to look to see, even more so from a coaching perspective, rather than mistaken, are they working? Are they working in present time? So that's exactly what we want to listen for, to see if someone's experiences are informed fully by all possibilities, rather than getting diverted into a coupling or an association that they have that is automatic, that they're not even aware that it's automatic. And you know this from from your former, may still be existing somewhat, life as a clinician, that, you know, all the couplings that can occur. In coaching, we deal with it a little bit differently. Here and now, looking at the framing of possibility and strategically planning that instead of going into the past. So is that enough, Kip, for right now for that?
Yep, thank you.
Good
perfect.
Question, though. Good question. Anybody else who we didn't get to, jot it down. Remember next time, if you can hang around a little bit, we'll talk and have a discussion after the seminar from a few minutes before, but at the top of the hour, and we'll add on some time there, 15 or 20 minutes, if you have some discussion. So jot down anything you'd like to for us to talk about, and I look forward to doing that. So thanks very, very much again, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Take good care of yourself.
Thank you, Dave.
You guys.
Take care.
Thank you, Dave.
Absolutely. See ya.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Great.